from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, the Grand Princess cruise ship is making its way now to the Port of Oakland for what could be a multiple-day effort to securely disembark thousands of passengers and transport them to quarantine sites. At least 21 people on board the ship have confirmed cases of COVID-19. Meantime, the largest school district in Northern California has shut down for a week after a family tested positive. We bring you the latest coronavirus-related developments in the Bay Area and take your questions after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. A cruise ship carrying passengers infected with coronavirus is expected to dock at the Port of Oakland around noon today. Governor Gavin Newsom says Oakland was the best site for the Grand Princess and pledged that none of the 3,000-plus passengers will be released to the public before undergoing a 14-day quarantine. Meanwhile, Bay Area residents are increasingly on edge. All NASA employees in Mountain View have been told to work remotely after a worker tested positive. Also, several local schools are closed today, with more closures likely. And San Francisco has shut down social, cultural, and other events at 50 or more people at city-owned facilities through at least March 20th. We're going to get the latest on how the virus is affecting the Bay Area. And we're joined now by San Francisco Mayor London Breed. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So before I get to the situation in San Francisco, I just want to ask you about the cruise ship and what role you played in the cruise ship being routed to Oakland. Did you lobby against the ship coming to San Francisco?
Well, to be clear, it was not our decision. We were involved in the conversations, and San Francisco stood ready to do whatever we could to be helpful and to be prepared, and to make sure that regardless of where this ship docked, that we were prepared to handle it and prevent the possible spread in our city. We were very supportive of working with the governor and working with the Center for Disease Control to decide on what was the best possible solution. So we stood ready, and even as the decision is made now to dock this ship in Oakland, we stand ready and prepared to help in any way we can. But ultimately, we had, unfortunately, no decision for where this ship was to be docked.
I only ask because there's a sense among some Oaklanders that this decision reflects the welfare of those residents being less important than San Francisco's. And I was just wondering what your message was to them.
Well, my message was that, you know, my message is, you know, unfortunately, you know, this is, you know, a really challenging time, and I can understand why people might feel that way. But the fact is, the decision that was made was in the best interest of public safety and public health, and, you know, was decided because this was a large open area that provided ease of access to the airport and less possibility of interaction with the public. Mm-hmm. And so I think there were really, you know, there were serious, it was a tough decision, but ultimately it was not done in a way to somehow, you know, imply that one city is more or less important than the other. It had nothing to do with that.
So the number of COVID-9 cases went from 2 to 8 in San Francisco over the weekend. I understand the 6 new cases had known contact with a person with a confirmed case. But clearly, you and other public health officials are saying that San Francisco should be prepared for more cases. So what are you recommending residents do?
Well, we have said time and time again to residents, if you're sick, stay home. You know, basically wash your hands. We recommend elbow bumps rather than shaking hands or even fist bumps. We don't touch your face, just those kinds of things. And just we have to be on high alert so that we could avoid the spread. We don't know who has come in contact with anyone. And we will be providing what looks like daily updates. And in fact, you know, as of today, we're up to 13 cases in San Francisco, and we plan to make announcements every afternoon so that people know exactly where we are. But ultimately, now that the test kits are available for us to get the results back sooner, we know that we're going to see more and more cases, and that's just a fact.
Right. And so the city has also stepped up its restrictions on gatherings of more than 50 at city-owned buildings. You know, Dr. Anthony Fauci also said over the weekend that it was possible that regional lockdowns could become necessary. I'm wondering if you've heard from the federal government about this and if San Francisco is already making contingency plans and the effect that that might be needed.
Well, we've been working on this particular issue since it was first brought to our attention in January. And as you know, about 2 weeks ago, I declared a state of emergency for San Francisco so that we can expand on our preparedness because we knew it wasn't whether or not it was going to happen in San Francisco. We knew that we would more than likely have cases in San Francisco, and we need to be prepared for any situation. So that we can mitigate the impacts on our city as a whole. And, you know, we are going to do whatever it takes to protect the public health. And that's what this is all about. And setting up whatever we need to set up, working with other hospitals, working with healthcare professionals, doing what's necessary to basically get through this. This is going to be, it already has been really tough. In our city, very challenging, especially for our economy. And we are going to weather the storm.
Speaking of hospitals, there's been a lot of concern about strain on hospitals, enough face masks for healthcare workers. And so as you're preparing for this, I know it's still kind of early, but as you're preparing to see a jump in cases, maybe more people coming in for testing, are you confident that San Francisco's healthcare system can handle that? And what are you asking residents to do to mitigate any strain on that system?
To be clear, San Francisco, we're not alone. We're not alone in our public health care system. You know, our partners with CPMC, Dignity, and other health care providers around the city have all stepped up to offer help and support. And in fact, by the end of this week, some of the private hospitals will be able to administer the tests directly in these particular cases. And so I think that we have partners, but could we use more? Of course we could. We need to make sure that ultimately the healthcare providers that are working with people who possibly have coronavirus, we need to make sure that we protect them. So that is going to be something that we're going to continuously advocate for so that we can ensure their safety, ultimately for the purposes of, again, mitigating the impacts of this disease.
You mentioned the concerns about the economy. Have you already quantified the potential economic hit to the city? We're hearing, of course, of canceled major events and potentially the city budget as well.
Well, we are doing that as we speak. We expect to know something sooner rather than later, probably this week. We know that a number of major conventions have already canceled. And we also know that it's not just an impact on, you know, just the money that they pay to use Moscone Center and other facilities. It's also their impact on restaurants, on hotels. And so right now our controller's office is doing a financial assessment to determine what the impacts are going to be. And the impacts will be significant. I mean, they have already proven significant for many of our small businesses, especially Chinatown and other places that rely on tourism and even people who live in the city who are choosing to stay indoors. Mm-hmm. And so we know that this is going to have a significant impact on our economy, on our budget, not just for San Francisco, but all over the country.
And you don't have a range yet in terms of just the economic hit generally?
Well, we don't have a range, but our city administrator's office, which is kind of oversees, you know, the facilities, the Moscone Center and you know, City Hall and others, has already estimated that just even the income alone from the cancellations could be about $5 million for just that. And so when you look at just even the rent we anticipated from the use of some of our city-owned facilities where events and conventions have been canceled, just think about that's just, a, you know, small in comparison to the larger impact. And so we'll have some numbers fairly soon.
Well, Mayor Breed, we so appreciate you talking with us today. I know you're headed to Sacramento to put your head together with other big city mayors regarding the coronavirus, and we appreciate you giving us your time this morning.
Thank you.
San Francisco Mayor London Breed. Let me tell you who is joining us now for the rest of the hour. We have Celine Gounder with us. She is an internist, an infectious disease specialist, and an epidemiologist. She's also the co-host and producer of the podcasts American Diagnosis and Epidemic, which focuses on the coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Gounder, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And also with us is Susan Phillips. She's the director of disease control and prevention at San Francisco's Department of Public Health. She's also the city's deputy health officer. Hello, Susan Phillips.
Hello.
Also with us is KQED's own Leslie McClurg. She is science reporter for KQED. Hi, Leslie.
Good morning.
And so let's go back to the cruise ship, because I know that's what's top of mind for everyone right now. Can you just lay out the plan for moving and testing these passengers? Because there are a lot of questions around this.
Absolutely. So the cruise ship right now is apparently about 10 or 11 miles offshore, and it will be brought in at about noon today with the help of what are called bar pilots. These are kind of expert navigators who will bring it in and, you know, use the tides and the winds, et cetera. This is to accurately dock this or to bring it in safely. This is not like parking a car. This is a giant ship with thousands of people. So they will bring it in around noon, and then the logistics are fairly complicated in terms of trying to get these people off the boat safely. So the first folks that will be brought in are those that are the sickest. So they will be transported to hospitals in the area and then obviously placed in isolation and quarantined and taken care of as quickly as possible. The next group that will be brought off are California residents. That's about 1,000 people. And those people will be taken to Air Force bases and quarantined for the next 14 days. And then a group of people will be taken, those that are going to be going to other countries will be transported to the Oakland airport. And there are promises from public health officials that they will be on charter flights, so they will not be exposed to the general public, and they will be heading off to their home countries. And then the last group that will be taken care of are the folks that are going, the other Americans, I guess I shouldn't say the last, they will also be flown, other Americans who are not Californians will be flown to either Georgia or Texas and also quarantined for 14 days. So this could take 2 to 3 days to get all of these logistics sort of unfolded. If you can imagine, like, thousands of people need to be coordinated in cars, et cetera, not exposed to the public. So that first line of defense, these bar pilots will be wearing hazmat suits to protect themselves. And I imagine anyone coming in contact with this group will also be in protective gear.
And we're hearing that the area will be sealed off. But what exactly does that mean?
It's a very good question, not that I have a very good sense of what that's going to be like. But like I said, protective gear, I'm sure barricades to make sure the public doesn't get nearby. Sealed off is obviously not I wish we could put like a big plastic wrap, right, over this group. That obviously can't happen. But I think there are as many measures as possible being put into place to protect the public.
Do you know how many people are expected to go to Travis Air Force Base in Solano County? Just because there were concerns, of course, especially after a whistleblower said that some federal health workers lacked proper training and gear. I mean, maybe that's been dealt with as of now. But, you know, the question is whether or not that contributed to the spread of the virus in Solano County.
There aren't exact numbers of how many people will be taken to specific places. So we don't know that yet. Hopefully
significantly more than they've had.
Yes. Hopefully lessons were learned and those protocols are in place. I think this is a moment that public health officials are either going to get this right, and there's a lot of eyes watching them to see if they're going to get this right. And so I know that there's a lot of tension to do this right, and there's been some fumbles so far in terms of getting testing up and running. And so whether or not this unfolds smoothly and safely is a question yet to be seen, but there's a lot of pressure for that to happen.
Dr. Celine Gounder, we've been getting assurances from elected officials that this operation poses a fairly minimal risk to the public. Do you agree?
Well, I think it depends on how it's handled. We've seen elsewhere that
public health officials and others have been asked to receive people coming off cruises or off chartered planes and haven't had the appropriate protective gear. So I think if they are given the appropriate protective gear, the gowns, the gloves, the masks, the face shields, this can be done safely in a controlled fashion.
Well, Robert writes, thank you to Mayor Libby Schaaf and Governor Gavin Newsom for displaying model leadership in a time of crisis instead of reacting with fear and antagonism towards those suffering on that ship. They displayed grace, compassion, and dignity, reminding us that we are all responsible for each other's welfare. Other leaders, including in Washington, D.C., should follow their example. And I should remind listeners, if you want to join the conversation, you can get in touch with us on Facebook, Twitter at KQED Forum, email us at forum@kqed.org, or call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. And just, you know, apropos of what Robert just said, Mayor Libby Schaaf did talk about how we have to not let our fears impede our humanity. But of course, you know, in these kinds of situations, Celine Gounder, I feel like one of the lessons that has been learned is perhaps from the Diamond Princess, that keeping people on a cruise ship for a long time can potentially contribute to the spread of coronavirus.
Well, that's exactly right. It's you're actually incubating and making the situation even worse and then releasing that out into the general public. So, you know, I think really you need to do what's right by the people on the ship, which is to move them to places, to quarantine sites where this can be done safely, where if people do get sick, they can access medical care. As you can imagine, if somebody needs an ICU level of care, that cannot be done on a cruise ship. And so I really think to remember that these are other Americans and people just like us. This could have been us. And they really do deserve appropriate medical care.
And Susan Phillip, I wanted to ask you about the question that I had asked Mayor Breed earlier in terms of San Francisco's capacity to handle the potential increase in cases, because I know that there is a big concern about strain on our healthcare system. And so could you talk about, you know, preparations for that and what are sort of the downstream effects if the health system is basically at max capacity trying to deal with coronavirus?
Absolutely. And that has been one of our focuses and focus points from the very beginning. And we have been activated as our department operations center since January 21st. So have been working on this for quite a while and have really been building on our existing strong relationships with preparedness coordinators at all of our hospitals in San Francisco and really our deep bench within our health department and within our city partners who have all been working together to prepare for this. And I will say that there has been really a lot of work and thought that has gone into what is necessary for providing the types of care at all levels that might be necessary for people who have COVID-19. And those plans are in place, and all of that is happening. And, you know, some of the measures that the mayor announced on Friday don't have to directly do with hospitalization and how we might be ready for that surge. But those measures are all things that all of us in San Francisco can play a part in to reduce the number of infections and reduce the people that might need our hospital. So it is very, very important to have the hospitals ready and have our capacity ready. And we have been working on that for weeks. And it is also important to try to decrease the number of infections in San Francisco to reduce the demand on that healthcare system.
Well, I'm hearing that we have council member, this is Oakland City Council member Lynette Gibson McElhaney on the line. Thanks for joining us, Council Member McElhaney, Gibson McElhaney.
Good morning, Mina. Good morning, everyone.
And of course, your district includes the Port of Oakland. And so can you tell us how confident you are that this situation will be handled well, which, of course, Dr. Gounder was saying was key to making sure that this doesn't have any impact on the public?
Well, so far, what we've been able to learn from our HHS and OES partners is that they're prepared, that they're familiar with using Travis, and that the area in the Port of Oakland was ideal so that it can be secured and executed with minimal, actually it seems like no contact to our existing workforce in the port areas or in our residents. And so, you know, we believe it's really important for them to handle the ship well so that we don't have increased exposure for the people who are on the ship or those coming off the ship. So from the plans that we laid out, we were just on a briefing call this morning. It appears that we are well situated to get all of the Californians disembarked, those who are medically in need first, and then those to follow on the buses and up to Travis so that we can get folks home and into their primary care and back to their home communities where they can be screened and served.
So you do have full confidence in this effort that it will be properly handled well?
I do. And I really appreciate the governor's office for leaning in. I will tell you that it sent shockwaves through the community. Folks were not happy. Oakland has a long history of environmental injustice and government actions that have not served us well. So I believe the community remains very skeptical, and it's going to be really important that the state and federal partners continue to keep us in the loop as they have and to provide real-time information and to coordinate with us if there's, you know, anything that's going to shift. But the area that they have selected and where they're staging is an area that's furthest away from any of the homes in Jack London, that's furthest away from any of our active births in port, and it seems ideally situated given its proximity to the lab in Richmond, to the East Bay corridor, to get people moved very quickly up the line with minimal exposure. And I think the other thing that we can really benefit from is to really continue to say in the public that this is not an airborne pathogen. You know, in order for it to be transmitted, it must be transmitted through droplets, it's immediate contact. There are those things about how the virus moves that should actually, once we know that, give us some calm that we don't have to. This is not a pandemic of sci-fi proportion where we need to lock everything down. And learning that and learning about the viruses is what's given me the confidence to know that we're not putting the Oakland community at risk.
And that's what you're telling residents to alleviate their fears in terms of respiratory droplets, not airborne, et cetera?
Yes, and we're, you know, really relying upon these updated bulletins that have been coming from Cal OES so that we can get the factual information out to the public. But there is a lot of fear and a lot of concern, and you know, this is part of the legacy when people have done you wrong that you just expect that you're not getting fair treatment. And I've heard it repeatedly. This comes right on the heel of TCE being found in the groundwater underneath McClymonds High School, also in the district.
Sure.
So there is a just a level of nervousness and concern about how we're treated, and the more we can continue to get information out and, you know, really urging the state to use all of the available avenues, whether it's, you know, posting on Nextdoor and getting things out on LinkedIn and Twitter, we've just got to continually get the information out so that we can calm the paranoia that's out there and the misinformation, quite honestly, that's beginning to spread.
Oakland Councilmember Lynette Gibson McElhaney, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for covering the story. We appreciate it.
We're talking with Dr. Celine Gounder, an internist, an infectious disease specialist, and an epidemiologist about the coronavirus. Also, Susan Phillip, Director of Disease Control and Prevention at San Francisco's Department of Public Health. And with KQED science reporter Leslie McClurg about the latest developments surrounding the coronavirus in the Bay Area and nationally. And we'll get to more of your questions and comments after the break. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. A cruise ship carrying passengers infected with coronavirus is expected to dock at the Port of Oakland around noon today. So far, at least 21 people on board the ship have confirmed cases of COVID-19. Meantime, several local schools are closed today. NASA Ames has shut down and asked employees to work from home. More closures of schools are likely. We're bringing you the latest coronavirus developments in the Bay Area and answering your questions with Dr. Celine Gounder. She's co-host and producer of the podcasts American Diagnosis and Epidemic. And also she's an internist, an infectious disease specialist, and an epidemiologist. Also with us is Dr. Susan Phillips. She's director of disease control and prevention at San Francisco's Department of Public Health. She's also the deputy health officer. And Leslie McClurg is with us. She's the science reporter for KQED. And you, our listeners, are with us with your questions or comments. You can call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Or you can post them on Facebook, on Twitter at KQED Forum, or email them to forum@kqed.org. And let me go straight to a listener question. Gary writes, I don't understand the hysteria coming from coronavirus. Every year, thousands of people die from the flu. Even though there is a vaccine available, hundreds of thousands or millions of people refuse to get the flu shot. So why now is coronavirus such a crisis? What am I missing? Dr. Gounder, do you want to respond to Gary's question? It's come up a lot.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think for one, this is going to be worse than your typical flu season. There's some estimates this might be 5 to 10 times worse than that ballpark. And, you know, I think it depends on who you are, how you worry about this. As a healthcare provider, as somebody who's going to be seeing potentially a huge spike in cases in the emergency room in terms of demand for ICU level care, this is very concerning. One, because it could be dangerous to healthcare workers who are swamped with cases, and that makes it much more difficult to maintain good infection control. And secondly, because it's going to be a challenge to provide the appropriate level of care to that many people. So I think as a healthcare provider, I am deeply concerned. I think if you're somebody who has a chronic medical illness, who's elderly, especially if you're 70s, 80s or above, as we've seen, nursing homes can be explosive in terms of coronavirus outbreaks, as we saw in Kirkland, Washington. And we know this is the case even with influenza. And so these are populations that we are deeply concerned about. You know, does the average American who's a young, healthy person need to be concerned for themselves? Less so. But, you know, this is not just about ourselves.
In meantime, I feel like there's been a marked shift in tone among national health officials, especially about their abilities to contain the outbreak. I mean, are we, Dr. Gounder, beyond the point of containment, really, and needing to be focused on mitigation?
I think we are. I think this is sort of the discussion, the debate that's been happening over the last couple of weeks. Do we call this an epidemic or a pandemic? And I've been saying for at least 2 weeks or more that this is a pandemic. It's a novel virus that is something that people have not been exposed to before, that they do not have immunity to, that is spreading across different continents in communities. And that basically means the cat's out of the bag. So it's less about things like travel restrictions and so on. And it's really about reducing disease severity and death and reducing the transmission to the degree that we can, especially to protect our most vulnerable in communities. And that is a shift in strategy. It does not mean let's panic. It means we have to shift our strategies. And when you have limited resources, allocate those resources where they're going to be most impactful.
So then you would mean, for example, the city and county of San Francisco instituting these measures where they're canceling events in city-owned buildings of more than 50 people for a couple of weeks, that is sort of a mitigation strategy as opposed to a containment strategy, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. The idea is to slow the spread, in particular to try to insulate the most vulnerable, the elderly and people with chronic medical conditions. And you're going to hear this expression, flatten the curve. What we mean by that is you don't want a huge spike of people coming into hospitals and clinics. If you can flatten that out where maybe as many people are infected over time, but if you stretch out that period of time, it makes it a lot more feasible for us to handle that influx of patients.
Well, let me go to some callers, and I'll start with Robin in Oakland. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I have some concerns. I just want to say I think that Oakland is generally treated as a dumping ground with all the other counties in the Bay Area. And I think they could have did some other measures. For example, maybe they should have had another cruise ship, you know, in the area that could have come, that could have been emptied, and they could have unloaded the people that were okay and put them on that cruise ship, and the others that were sick, then address them. I think politically, maybe Oakland does not have the political power in order to prevent folks coming into our port. We're not set up for that. There's a lot of small business in Oakland. Of course, the port is huge with regard to business. And I think bringing the folks that have the illness is going to be a risk to that neighborhood. And I also think, just from being a resident of Oakland for a very long time and watching how things happen, regentrification is a huge thing that happens, or should say has happened in our city, and maybe there's not enough of it in West Oakland to prevent this kind of thing from happening.
Robin, thanks for sharing those thoughts. And Susan Phillip of San Francisco DPH. I mean, Robin is representing perspectives that I've heard quite a bit ever since the decision was made for the ship to go to Oakland, because, of course, San Francisco is the entity that typically takes cruise ships. You know, Councilmember Larry Reed made the point that they're used to this, that they have the facilities. So can you say, Susan Phillip, that it's safer for the ship to be in Oakland than in San Francisco?
Well, I will tell you that the San Francisco Department of Public Health was not one of the key agencies that was making these decisions. This was really between the federal authorities and the state Office of Emergency Services. So this was a state and federal operation. We in DPH here in San Francisco were involved to the extent that we needed to be aware of what was happening and be aware in case medical facilities were needed urgently for any of the passengers on board. So I'm not the correct person to speak to, you know, the decisions that were made or how
sure,
they were
but
made.
Do you have an opinion? Do you have an opinion in terms of whether or not the Port of Oakland was truly the best site versus San Francisco?
What I know is what we have all heard from the media was that it was based on being able to take a ship of that size and be able to do it in an area that could be isolated, a 10-acre or 11-acre area that could be kind of cordoned off where there were not populations living nearby. But again, I am not the expert to speak to that. I'm happy to speak to the work that we're doing in San Francisco.
Well, if anybody feels like they may have symptoms, what should they do?
Well, I think it's challenging, as we know, because it is cold and flu season, and there are a lot of viruses that are not the COVID-19 virus that are circulating at the time. But people can check with their providers, with their usual providers, and particularly people that are in the more vulnerable groups, older people or people with chronic health conditions should be checking in if they do develop symptoms that are cold or flu-like. What's a really great boon right now, which is wonderful, is that we have and we expect an increase in access to testing for patients because the large commercial laboratories have come online with mm-hmm. testing either late last week or today. And that is going to be a wonderful boon. You know, our public health laboratories, including our laboratory in San Francisco, have been among the first to be able to start testing, but we were never set up to be the sole place for clinical testing for all patients. So having that access to commercial testing will really allow people and their providers to know more of what's going on and to then appropriately sort of follow up with isolation and other procedures that will help prevent continued spread in the community.
You're starting to answer this listener's question. Ernest writes, what is the capacity of the San Francisco Department of Public Health to test people for COVID-19? How many people a day can be tested at this point?
Yes. In our laboratory, it's very limited capacity. And again, the role of public health laboratories, they're critically important. And we're so fortunate to have one in San Francisco. They are really the first. So whenever there is a novel infection, those laboratories, as part of the network with the state and with CDC, are the first to get testing. And then from there, it goes to commercial and other entities, other academic partners, et cetera. So our capacity is quite limited. It's between probably 30 and 50 patients a day. And so for that reason, we're reserving our public health lab capacity for really the highest priority for public health overall. And so that includes people that are hospitalized and quite sick, because both for their own diagnosis and care and also for the healthcare worker issue, protecting healthcare workers and making sure that we have all the right isolation procedures in place, as Dr. Gounder was mentioning. But then also for people who are contacts. So we are doing mitigation. We are in a time in which we are telling people to know that there's community spread and that they should be taking measures to reduce their contact with other people. But at the same time, we're doing the phase of containment still as well. Mm-hmm. So we're finding cases, talking to partners, testing them. And so those are another priority group for our public health lab. But these commercial labs will be much more able to take the large volume of patients that we know might be interested in testing as well.
Well, let me go next to caller Jacob in San Francisco. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I'm a nurse at a local hospital, Seton Medical Center in Daly City. And you mentioned the strain that hospitals will be facing with this viral outbreak. And I just wanted to bring it to everybody's attention because I feel it's being underreported in the news that Verity Health System is actually in the process of trying to shut this hospital down as this viral outbreak is happening. So that will put a strain on all the other hospitals in the area. This is a busy hospital with a busy ER, hundreds of beds, and this is actually happening now during this outbreak.
Jacob, thanks for sharing. Susan Phillip, how concerned are you about additional strain on San Francisco as a result of this closure?
Well, you know, again, we are preparing, and we feel that we have the isolation beds, we have the know-how, and we have plans in place for even for surge beyond that. But I can't emphasize enough that the actions that Mayor Breed and Dr. Colfax, the Director of Health, have announced late last week are really intended to try to decrease the demand on the hospital. So we have to be thinking in both of those areas at once. And the mitigation processes, the social distancing requests, that is something that applies to everyone, all the listeners of this show. And those are ways in which we can try and decrease the spread, flatten the curve, as Dr. Gounder was saying, and really allow us to try and preserve these critical hospital facilities, hospital beds that we need for very sick people, and people that are not just sick with COVID-19, but people continue to need emergency surgery, have heart attacks. We need to be able to preserve our medical right. capacity. So it's always a concern that we have.
Well, I know we only have you, Susan Phillip, till the quarter hour. So I'm going to try to get one more question in about San Francisco, and that's Jerome. Join us, Jerome.
Hi, good morning. My question is about schools. I know that there's been some schools that have been closed, but I'm just wondering why we're not being a little more proactive about trying to protect the teachers and the students in the community. I know that there's a couple of schools that have been closed, but I wonder about siblings and just different kind of contacts. I know a number of teachers, and they are in contact with a lot of families on a daily basis. I mean,
Jerome, thank you. Yes. Well, let me just see if I can get Dr. Phillip before she needs to leave us to address your concerns. Susan Phillip.
Yes, and schools are a big area of focus and a big area of discussion that we've continued to have here in our department, but also with the state and federal partners. And it's an active area of discussion, and recommendations may change in the future for schools. But we know it's extremely disruptive to families, to students, to their education. We also don't have clear evidence that closing schools for a short period of time would be helpful. In countries where school closures have happened, they've been for very prolonged periods of time. And we just right now, in consultation with state and federal partners and all the information we have, don't believe that that prolonged type of closure is indicated right now. But, you know, as you can see, these things are very dynamic. If there are instances where there might be a person who's diagnosed with COVID-19, who is a staff member, a faculty member, a student, then there will be an individual discussion with the school and the school district in San Francisco to make that decision. And certainly individual schools may decide themselves to take other action. They know their communities and their families best. But as of now, as of today, there is no general recommendation for closing schools in San Francisco.
Well, Dr. Susan Phillip, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Susan Phillip with San Francisco's Department of Public Health. With us for the remainder of the hour is, of course, Celine Gounder. She's an internist and an infectious disease specialist, and also KQED's Leslie McClurg. And, you know, one of the things, Dr. Gounder, that Susan Phillip brought up was just the increased capacity for testing. And I understand that in Seattle, at least, that a Gates-funded project is going to try to start offering home testing kits that will allow people who feel like they've been infected to swab their noses and send the samples back for analysis. First of all, what are your thoughts on that and how quickly that could be rolled out and how effective that could be in terms of getting detection quickly?
Yeah, I think this University of Washington program is really innovative. What they're doing in terms of testing, in terms of trying to do this in the home, at least in the Seattle area. They're also doing drive-through testing, which is something that was done before this, both in South Korea and the United Kingdom, where they're using a parking garage at the University of Washington where people can drive up in their car, somebody takes a swab, and sends it off to the lab, and you never have to leave your car. And I think these kinds of innovative approaches are what we really need. We need to change how we think about how we deliver healthcare. And, you know, I think this is the sort of creative thinking that's really required right now.
Yeah. I think, though, when people hear about such things, there is this question of why now? Why weren't we doing this earlier, working with biotechs, major foundations with these kinds of resources? Because we've been hearing just how important testing is to containing coronavirus.
Yeah, I don't think that – I think it'd be unfair to say that nothing has been happening all along. But we have massively underinvested on the public health side. This is a country where we really like to invest in basic science research because that research then leads to marketable, profitable drugs, diagnostics, to a lesser degree, vaccines. But we don't like to invest in public health. And the fact is – we're seeing very acutely now that if you don't invest in public health, if you don't protect yourself in that way, you will suffer in other ways financially, as we're seeing with the stock markets this week. And I think, unfortunately, there's an attitude that these people are undeserving of public health services. And there's a moral judgment about this that really is self-defeating.
Would you say, though, the lack of initial testing was probably one of the biggest missteps that we've made as a country?
Oh, absolutely. But again, that's a reflection of tremendous underfunding at the CDC. We've lost since about 2003 or so, we've lost about a quarter of the public health workforce in this country. That's not something that's you can ramp up at the last minute. And so part of what happened at the CDC, yes, there were some fumbles, but I think that's also because they're really overextended.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me go to Sarah in Orinda. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, great to be with you this morning. I'm a physician in the community here in the Bay Area. I've been following the novel coronavirus pretty closely for a couple months. And I just want to say that it's seeming to me more and more clear that we're past a containment stage. It's been mentioned on the show this morning. And so as an individual that I, you know, I see myself as somebody who is fairly privileged in the area. For us and for my family, you know, some of the things that have been suggested with social distancing are not a hardship. My husband has a job where he's able to work from home and maintain our health care benefits and his same salary. I do telemedicine, so I see patients from home, would be able to have our children home with us if the school were to close. Fortunately, we have a fridge that's full of food, things like that. So I really feel that for people in the community that do have privilege, you know, I'm worried about the folks that don't, people who are homeless, who are incarcerated, for whom food insecurity is a day-to-day issue, for whom school closings would be a hardship, who are hourly workers. So I guess I just wanted to encourage the community, folks that do have privilege, I think the time is now to really start practicing social distancing. If you can, it's not even so much about you not getting sick, but as has been mentioned several times today, flattening that curve and really helping the community and trying to slow things down to keep the strain off our healthcare resources and protect our more vulnerable populations.
Well, Sarah,
and I'll take my response off the air.
Yes, I appreciate you raising that because more and more, Leslie McClurg, we're hearing about the strain of this on low-wage workers, mm-hmm. people who rely on people to go to work and spend their money or to transport those folks to from place to place. I mean, they don't have the kind of safety net that is needed in situations like this. Can you talk about that a little bit? And also the bigger question, too, about our homeless population. And one of the things that KQED has been reporting on is just the extent to which, you know, homeless encampments are so vulnerable. I mean, they don't have the means to take the necessary steps to protect themselves, these encampment residents, you know, from something like coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, last week when I was on the air, I said, you know, the first step to do is to make sure to call your doctor first if you're starting to feel, you know, sick or if you're having trouble breathing, which is the protocol that public health officials are recommending. But, you know, some people don't have a doctor on the line that they can call. Their form of medical care, the homeless population, is the emergency room. So they are going to go immediately to the emergency room. And as you can imagine,
I can hear you.
As you mm-hmm. can What's that? Is that
Dr. Gowner?
Somebody's asking me, can you hear me now?
Oh.
Oh.
That's odd. Anyways. Okay, sorry, we weren't sure if you were trying to break
little,
in
little
or
technical,
not.
Little technical.
Yeah, it was getting picked up.
I mean, if you can imagine, you know, down the street from my house, there's a large homeless encampment, and those folks are living in really close proximity. They're sharing tables. You know, volunteers come and bring in their food. So the potential for disease to spread in these encampments is quite high, and the medical, you know, means is not there necessarily to slow down the inflow from homeless encampments to the emergency rooms. That could be a potentially quite intense problem. In terms of low-wage workers, you know, these folks don't have sick leave. They don't have the ability to stay home and take care of their kids. Often those folks are living paycheck to paycheck. And as you can imagine, in San Francisco, that's even more the case in a place that's so expensive to live. So this particular population is going to be hit the hardest, as is usual, unfortunately, in these natural disasters.
And as this continues...
Not that this is a natural disaster, but as is usually happens, you know, in earthquakes, et cetera.
Yes, and as this continues, I'm sure we'll be hearing more and more stories about how this is affecting people's lives. Let me go next to Shruti in Oakland. Hi, Shruti.
Hi. So actually, I want to make sure that how people who are traveling from infected countries like Japan and so they quarantine themselves for couple of days at least, or and their family. Because I have a neighbor who just traveled from Japan, and he also went to India. He just came Saturday night, and there was not enough checks on the airport. And so, but I'm not sure they are quarantining themselves in the home or not.
Oh, you mean in terms of trying to make people participate in a quarantine or self-quarantine if they've traveled from infected places?
Self-quarantine them, and their family. Because right now they do not have symptoms, but the incubation period is so long that he may be exposed, but we do not know.
Well, Sliyakonda, what do you recommend in that situation if you've traveled someplace that has a high rate of infections?
Well, you know, I think if you've traveled from someplace like China or Iran or Italy, where there has been an extremely high rate of infection, CDC's has level 3 travel advisories for those countries. Japan, to be fair, is a level 2 travel advisory. You know, but if you are coming from one of the hardest hit countries, I do think it is wise to be trying to self-quarantine for the 14-day period without contact with others, but also to be, as soon as you do have symptoms, to be reaching out for testing and care.
Well, this listener tweets, can a recovered patient of COVID-19 still be contagious?
So there's been some confusion about this because the way we test people for this, the vast majority of people are being tested with a test called PCR, which is really looking for RNA, which is sort of analogous to DNA for us. But the problem is you can find that, you know, just like if you go to a crime scene, you can find DNA even after the person's gone. The same thing can happen with the virus. So with a lot of viral infections, we don't actually do what we call a test of cure with a PCR test for DNA, or in this case, RNA, because it can remain positive even after live virus is gone. And so this is something that still needs to be studied more. But what we think is that if you're symptomatically better, and that we are still checking PCRs upon recovery, but we think if you are symptomatically better, that it is probably not contagious at that point.
And if you recover from it, can you get it again? That's also been a question that's come up.
Well, and that's also related to people being PCR positive, so testing positive on and off after recovery. And again, it's sort of like you have these fingerprints left over, doesn't necessarily mean you're sick with this again. And the problem is, you know, ideally you would be testing for live virus and growing up the virus itself, but that creates all kinds of biosafety issues for labs. So that's not something that can be done in a wide scale. It's really just in a research setting. However, from what we know with other coronaviruses, you know, the experience has been that you have immunity for about 1 to 3 years after being infected. So we do not think that these positive tests after being sick really represent a new infection. It's really just lingering testing positive after you had the original infection.
Well, I'm being told that we have a cruise ship passenger, a passenger on the Grand Princess, on the line with us. Michelle Heckert, are you there?
Hi, yes.
Hi, Michelle. So tell us your situation. I understand you're with your grandparents.
I am with my grandparents, and my grandma's here, on the phone with me.
How are you feeling?
Sorry, I was just going to say that I think, feeling a little bit more hopeful now that we know we were docking today. And then hopefully we were told to pack. So I think that means that we'll be able to disembark in the very near future. We don't have an exact time for that yet, but at least, you know, we're getting ready for that.
I see. So you're not showing symptoms or potentially one of the first folks to leave, because the ones that have that need medical attention will be that first group, is my understanding. But do you know where you're going? Have you been told? Hi, Michelle, are you there?
We're supposed. Yes, she's here. But I understand. This is her grandmother.
Oh.
I understand that we're going to go to a military place where we're going to be quarantined for 14 days. And I believe it's at, what's the name
Travis.
Of this? Travis Air Force Base.
So you'll be going to Travis. You know, we just unfortunately have about 30 seconds or so. I'm wondering if you could just tell us how it's been for you, how you've been dealing with this.
Well,
it has been a bit of a struggle and just really unforeseen circumstances, but we're trying to stay positive and find other ways to cope. And for me, that's music. And for my grandparents, that's, you know, exercising and, you know, staying active and trying to distract ourselves.
And Michelle, what's your grandmother's name?
Adelina.
Adelina and Michelle, well, thank you both for talking with us. And do stay in touch. We'd love to hear how your situation plays out. And best of luck to you both as well. Dr. Gander, you know, we only have a minute left, and I know it's very early to say, but and that you cannot predict the future. But based on the latest developments, your medical knowledge, what do you think is the trajectory of this outbreak in the U.S.?
Well, I do think a large proportion of the population, say on the order of 40% or so, will eventually become infected in the coming year, 18 months or so. I think the real question is, do we see this happen as a big spike, or can we flatten the curve? And if you have 100 people coming into an emergency room in one day, that's very different from 100 people over the course of a month. So I really hope that we can do what it takes to make this something a more manageable problem for all of us.
Dr. Celine Gounder, internist, infectious disease specialist, and epidemiologist, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Leslie McClurg, thanks to you for your reporting on this.
Thank you, Mina.
I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.